You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, conciliatory or tougher than ever, we examine the multiple public images of China's Xi Jinping as a series of daily snapshots appear on Chinese microblogging sites.
The Chinese government clearly worries about its global image, and they are trying to figure out all sorts of ways to try to make themselves look better in the world.
We'll hear more from Raffaello Pantucci in just a few moments' time. Also ahead, what's it like to be free? We talk to the Africa correspondent of The Independent. He's fresh back from the newly liberated Malian city of Timbuktu. And Greek police try to Photoshop the evidence. A suspect's black eyes mysteriously vanish from their mugshots. We assess the reputation of a force accused of brutality.
They're saying that essentially they cleaned up the pictures so the public could recognize them when they released the mugshots. But of course, in the past, the police has been accused of very violent tactics.
And we join the mix of former political prisoners, poets and authors from around the world who are gathering at Burma's first free literary festival.
I've been talking about the groundbreaking nature of this event for a while, but seeing it today, you realize quite how groundbreaking it is.
All that, plus we'll play you some great music too. That's all coming up here in the next hour on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
The first US Patriot missile battery deployed in southeastern Turkey to defend the country from stray attacks from Syria has reached an initial operational capability. The Missile Defense Commander, Steve Richmond, has confirmed today.
Both batteries are not fully operational at this time. We only have one battery here right now. It declared an initial operational capability this morning. The Turkish government is completing some additional site prep to ensure that it can perform its mission properly, and we expect that site prep to be done later this month.
Meanwhile, Syrian fighters opposed to President Bashar al-Assad's rule have clashed with the regime's army in an attempt to gain control of a strategic town near Aleppo. The fighters are attempting to gain control of key locations in Khan Asal, which is 7 miles west of Aleppo. The rebels are now trying to cut off supplies to the army. FBI agents in Alabama have stormed an underground bunker and rescued a 5-year-old boy called Ethan, who'd been held hostage by a gunman for nearly a week. The gunman, Jimmy Dykes, was killed in the attack. It's believed a stun or flash grenade was detonated as part of the operation to free the boy. Well, Wally Olson, the sheriff of Dale County, says everyone is now relieved that Ethan is safe.
We were certainly concerned for the safety of the child. I can tell you that I've been to the hospital, I have visited with Ethan. He is doing fine. He's laughing, joking, playing, eating, the things that you would expect a normal 5 to 6 year old to do. He's very brave, he's very lucky, and the success story is that he is out safe and doing great.
Staying in the States, and the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, will be ceremonially sworn in by Vice President Joe Biden at the State Department on Wednesday. Kerry, who was formally sworn in as the 68th Secretary of State last week, became the top U.S. diplomat after 5 terms in the U.S. Senate, where he served on the Foreign Relations Committee for some 28 years, the last 4 as its chairman. A few hundred European Union employees held a short strike today and gathered outside the EU Commission building to protest against possible cuts in their salaries. Félix Guillardon is a translator for the European Union and is also General Secretary of the Union Syndicale.
The purpose of this protest is to show to the Member States that we need a European budget that allows the European Union to fulfill its mission. Because if some Member States cut the budget as heavily as they want to, the European Union will no longer be able to function.
Here, the British Parliament has started a debate on the government's plans to legalise gay marriage, an issue that has split the ruling Conservative Party. Opening the debate, Equalities Minister Maria Miller said the proposals would protect freedom of faith and extend equality to gay couples.
The depth of feeling, love and commitment is no different between same-sex couples than opposite-sex couples. This bill enables society to recognise that commitment in the same way too, through marriage. Parliament should value people equally in the law, and enabling same-sex couples to marry removes the current differentiation and distinction.
And finally, Norway is in the middle of a nappy shortage after a supermarket price war lured enterprising bulk shoppers from Eastern Europe who've now cleared out the shelves. Supermarkets in the south of the country have been trying to lure local customers by undercutting rivals on the price of nappies, inadvertently making it profitable enough for residents of nearby countries to start trading in them. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. I hope you meant that people will be trading in them insofar as they will be trading the nappies. They won't be trading while wearing them.
Exactly.
The time is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. French troops wrestled control of the Malian city of Timbuktu only last week. However, they are already withdrawing, their job done, and their focus turning northwards. There is a growing feeling that France's mission in Mali has now peaked, and what remains in the likes of Timbuktu is at least a handover to local troops. It's less than a year since the city fell to Islamist rebels and a brutally strict interpretation of Islamic law was imposed on daily life. So what state is this city in after such tremendous upheaval? Well, Dan Howden is the Africa correspondent for the Independent newspaper. He was in Timbuktu last week when it fell to the French troops. He is now in Nairobi, having returned from Timbuktu yesterday. Dan, a very warm welcome to the programme. Just describe to us what happened in Timbuktu last week while you were there.
Well, by the time that I was able to get into the city, it was in the hours after French paratroopers had dropped in, sealed off the north gate, and a French army column had come to the south gate. They secured the whole of the city. Not a shot was fired. And most of the people who had been ruling over the town in that period had already left. So what was left was basically a big party. After 10 months, there was television, football playing. There were women and men talking to each other. There was dancing, there was singing, and there was a lot of Vive la France and Vive le Mali. So it was a real celebration.
It was a real celebration, and there was genuine joy at the French troops' presence. How long do you think this will last? Not necessarily just the troops of the French army, but of the of international peacekeepers who will be coming in too.
Well, the north of Mali, and specifically the population in Timbuktu, is about 50,000. When I went into the city itself, that population was maybe down to one third. All Arabs and Tuaregs, who made up a large proportion of the people in the city, had fled. They've gone to outlying villages, and what you had essentially was the people who had been on the rough end of the last 10 months, and obviously they were very happy to see the French. The big question is, what happens now that the French have left? Will these people come back to reclaim their looted stores? Will there be a second phase or some kind of blowback? And if the French troops aren't there in order to secure the local population, what is going to be, is there going to be some kind of intercommunal violence? Are we going to see some elements of the jihadists return? I mean, this is what we're all waiting to see. What happens next in Mali? Phase one has been accomplished. Timbuktu was the peak of that. But now that the French are drawing down their forces in these garrison towns, is the Malian army and are the other African forces that are coming, are they going to be able to do the same job? Or are we going to see some kind of degeneration into a longer-term conflict?
How scarred has Timbuktu and its residents been left by 10 months under strict, strict interpretations of Islamic law?
I think the thing to understand is, if I were to pick one country in Africa and say that this is a country where Sharia law would be a total stranger would be a very odd fit. I think I would probably pick Marley. Music is a huge part of life. There's relatively liberal relations between the two sexes. There's a big diversity of communities. There's maybe 8 different ethnic communities in Timbuktu. So it was always a really odd fit. In really basic terms, and one hand was severed and one person was executed during that reign. And 10 months, you have to say that possibly it's not as brutal as it's being portrayed. But the reality of day-to-day life and the difference between how normal life had been for that community and how it was under the jihadis means that people took it really badly. It was a tourist town. It was a cultural center. It was a center of diversity. It was a center of music. If you talk to jewelers who were making these fabulous Dofor headdresses for weddings, all of this was shut down. So people really felt like they'd been prisoners. And prisoners was the word that people kept saying to me when I was asking them how they had felt during the occupation.
And what will happen to those who will be considered as having collaborated with the Islamists after they are now left pretty much high and dry?
Well, I've described day one, and that was very much a party atmosphere and a celebration. Day two was vengeance. On the streets, any shop, any warehouse, any petrol station that was connected in any way to people who had been seen as collaborators, it was literally torn to shreds. And the stores were stripped back, the wooden shelves were removed, even the metal door frames. Everything was taken. And the Malian army just stood by. So it seems there's considerable anger towards these communities. I met myself only one Tuareg person in Timbuktu during the time that I was there, and he was almost accepted as somewhat of a kind of village fool. He was tolerated by the local community. So for now, the people who are seen as collaborators of this have disappeared from the town completely. The question, and it's not just in Timbuktu, it's in Gao, it'll be in Kidal further north, is what happens when the full population is restored, when these communities have to come back together? What kind of accounting will there be? It's always in this kind of the post-conflict situation, the longer-term questions about how communities resolve differences and how crimes are punished, that's the key to whether there's future stability.
And building on that idea of regional stability, how can a situation like that be helped at all by a central government which seems to have no strength in itself?
Well, the story of Mali is really the story of the collapse and failure of the state. The central government was gutted by its own incompetence and corruption. They lost control of their army. They were massively eroded and eaten from the inside by incredibly lucrative drug trade that passed through. And this central and elite collapse was what then precipitated a broader collapse and created the space for what was essentially an Islamic insurgency that was born in Algeria to cross into the north of Mali and find some space to flourish and to bloom there, and then to try and capitalize on that and take over the whole of Mali, which ended up being an overreach. So unless you can give some legitimacy and create some kind of central government in Mali which has control over the armed forces and some recognition from the broader population in what is a very ethnically diverse country, then there won't be a future for Mali, and there's a limit to what France can do. France has done what it can. It would very much like to withdraw. It will probably try to rebrand this force as a UN force and leave some troop presence. But ultimately, the solution will have to be political, and it will have to come from Malians themselves, and it will have to start from the capital and from the government.
Dan Howden from the Independent newspaper in Nairobi, thanks as ever for your time. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up, we'll assess claims that Greece's police tried to clean up mugshots of suspected bank robbers after it was alleged that officers got a touch heavy-handed with their interrogation techniques. Stay with us.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time. We hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Time is just approaching 16 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Now, Greece's police are being accused of trying to Photoshop their own evidence after it was claimed that mugshots of a group of accused bank robbers were cleaned up to hide the bruises and the black eyes that they may well have been sustained when they were in custody. Amnesty International has called for an investigation, and it's led to allegations that the abuse of people in custody is commonplace. Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards spoke to the Greek journalist Natalis Savarikas before we came to air to explain why Greece's police are resorting to such brutal tactics.
Well, what essentially happened is the police arrested four youths after they attempted to rob two banks in the northern city of Kozani. And they allegedly beat them very severely. And after they doctored the pictures, the mugshots, if you like, of these youths, because we essentially see two pictures that were taken by the press where you can actually see the signs of bruises and the black eyes, if you like. And yet, when we see the mugshots of the police, it seems that they have cleaned them up pretty well by using Photoshop. At least that is what the family of the youths are saying.
I have some of these pictures in front of me. This is of one of the suspects, Nikos Romanos. He's clearly very bloodied. He has a very serious injury to his eye. In the next image, which is one released by the police, it's plainly been adjusted. He sort of almost looks cartoonified, looks like a manga character. Are the police just completely unafraid about being accused of these kind of doctoring of images? Are they so sure of their ground? They're so belligerent in their attitude. They don't care about being accused because they must have known that people would, call them out on this behaviour.
The police, what the authorities are saying, including the Minister of Public Order, they're saying that essentially they cleaned up the pictures so the public could recognize them when they released the mugshots. But of course, in the past, the police has been accused of very violent tactics when they were arresting, especially members of the anarchist movement, these youths wear black and are very often at the demonstrations in Athens that are very end up being quite violent. And there is some sort of immunity, if you like, with the police and with the tactics that they've used. The press has exposed such tactics in a Guardian piece that was published just over a month ago, where many youths came out accusing the police of violence and of torture after being arrested and during their interrogation.
Tell me a little bit more about this actual group involved in this. They're supposedly an urban guerrilla organisation, these young men. One of them, the chap I mentioned there, Nikos Romanos, supposedly from quite a salubrious neighbourhood of Athens, from quite a wealthy background. He's describing himself as a prisoner of war. Is this typical of some of these disaffected youth? They're not only the people at the, you know, on the sort of most hard line of economic suffering, but often they're from quite relatively wealthier backgrounds, but they're seeming to also engage in some of the rhetoric that we're seeing where with the movement in mainstream politics to the extremes on both right and left.
Well, essentially, after, I'm just going to explain some of the background. So after retrieving their fingerprints, after this bank robbery, the police soon linked two of the detained men to a terrorist group, as you mentioned, which is called Conspiracy of the Cells of Fire, and they had been tried in absentia already. Now, these youths usually come from very wealthy backgrounds, and one of them was even the friend of a teenager killed back in 2008, Alexei Grigoropoulos, and his death, he was essentially murdered by a police officer, and his death triggered mass riots in Greece that Christmas. Now, it does show how these youths in Greece are very disappointed with the establishment, are challenging the status quo and want change. But it also shows, if you like, a shift in society that revolution, if you like, is the only way to change things. But it's also very sad because it shows how the establishment has failed to provide any hope to young people, and especially of the wealthier generation, and they feel that they need to take up arms against the authorities and the political establishment to see any change to their country.
A number of critics of the government and the handling of this, I know amongst the radical left party, the Syriza party, has said it's a disgrace and this is evidence of, you know, the right wing direction the government's going. It's targeting people's freedoms and democracy itself. That's perhaps the kind of language we would expect from them. But in terms of the centre ground of the Greek political sphere, will there be similar levels of outrage? Do you think people have almost had enough of these kind of instances?
The Greek public is sick and tired of the way the police and the authorities overall deal with such instances. And of course, the public order minister, Nikos Dendias, did say that cases of torture will not be tolerated. And if the police is indeed found guilty, the men will be severely punished. But of course, this is not the first time the police has come under attack for its controversial and very violent tactics. And something will have to be done. They will need to change this as the public in Greece is becoming increasingly tired and increasingly angry at the authorities for engaging in such tactics.
And that was the Greek journalist Natalie Savarakis talking to Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards a little earlier on. You're with Midori House. Now, it was announced here in the UK on Monday that the owners of the London Evening Standard and independent newspapers have won the battle to broadcast from London's local television licence. It's thought that the new licence should be the most lucrative since Channel 5 was allowed to become the fifth national terrestrial channel in the UK in 1997. So what might we find on it? And is multimedia ownership the only way to be profitable? The media commentator Stephen Armstrong spoke to our culture editor Robert Bound a little earlier on.
Who are the other front runners in the battle to control this lucrative TV licence?
It was a collection of, well, it was what you might expect. It was other TV operators and production companies. These local TV licences in the UK are seen by a lot of people as a way to a lot of people who make TV programmes know that one way of maximising it is to have somewhere where you can practice your content, where you can try stuff out, and where you can where you can sample ideas. Now, I suppose one of the reasons that the government decided to award the Evening Standard, effectively Lebedev's company, the contract is because they had a better view of London. The award said it said they've got a better feeling for the diversity of London life. So it seemed clear that they were the ones who were going to be getting actively involved in London rather than seeing this as some TV that they could toy with.
So there's a phrase, isn't there, the super indie, which is prevalent in a lot of Soho production companies in London. It's not just a playground for them to test out material.
That's right. And I mean, of course, the problem might be seen, which we've seen the authorities announce that they don't have a problem with this because London is a very thriving, diverse market. Of course, that does give Alexander Lebedev control over quite a lot of London's media. It gives him the Evening Standard, which is the daily evening newspaper. It gives him this TV station, and it gives him a free newspaper as well. So there's a lot of people who are dealing directly with him. Interestingly, Lebedev, who, when he first arrived in the UK, you know, with his past effectively an oligarch with some KGB connections. There were those who wondered what he was doing getting into the media, but it does look like in his time here he's convinced readers and the authorities that he doesn't have any Machiavellian intent with his media operations. Indeed, things are going so badly for him in Russia at the moment that it may just be that this is a place for him to get away from the problems of having his airline license suspended and being put on trial for hooliganism by Putin's government.
And what sort of stuff can we expect to see on the airwaves? I think they're broadcasting 18 hours a day. That's the plan. Is it going to be the Evening Standard light? Is it going to be the Evening Standard on TV?
There's going to be elements where journalists are going to be multimedia journalists. It's going to be stuff that's reported by the Standard and the Independent. He has a national newspaper called the Independent Reporters. If you look at the person who's running it, she's the program director, Jane Moat, who used to be managing director at Current TV, which was Al Gore's kind of low budget, allow people to take a camera, get out there and film it channel, recently bought by Al Jazeera in the United States. So she's going to be, I think, stamping the kind of the visual identity on it. A lot of the content is going to be coming from the Evening Standard's newsroom. They're also going to have entertainment. It's not clear what sort of budget the entertainment is going to get, but we have seen that Tiger Aspect founder Peter Bennett-Jones, who is one of the biggest comedy producers in the UK, and also they've got the Food Network boss, Nick Thorogood. So, seeing as in the UK, chef...
So quite a nice, styly mix.
Chefs can print money, basically, by getting some TV broadcasting. They seem to be fairly sound. Comedy, chef and news would seem like a reasonable combination.
And the key for Lebedev, presumably also for the rest of his media empire, the Evening Standard, the Independent, is whether he can leverage advertising to make the whole of his empire profitable on the back of this. What are the chances of that, do you think?
At the moment, the advertising industry is not in the position where it wants to do those kinds of deals. The ISBA, which is, if you like, the lobbying body of the actual advertisers rather than the advertising agencies, are constantly trying to ensure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. They're very keen to avoid dominance in any part of the advertising market. It's one of the reasons they're always campaigning against ITV's. Basically, in the UK, the largest channel, ITV, has its advertising heavily government-restricted, partly because the ISBA have lobbied for this kind of pluralism. It is a small channel at this stage. If it works well, though, it does suggest that if you're going to be in print, you also need to be in broadcasts. I mean, Rupert Murdoch has been forced to split that, and that's causing all sorts of ructions at the top level of his empire. So it may be that we can no longer see the individual kinds of media operating separately. Indeed, for instance, like Monocle and Monocle Radio, you might see that all print operations and need to have broadcast, or all broadcasts need print.
And that was the media commentator Stephen Armstrong talking to our culture editor Robert Bowner. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In the next half hour of today's programme, we'll ask whether the state is behind Xi Jinping's amazing makeover, and we head to Burma to a literary festival celebrating the nation's newfound freedom of speech.
I've been talking about the groundbreaking nature of this event for a while, but seeing it today, you realise quite how groundbreaking it is.
All that coming up, plus the news is just around the corner. Taking us there, this is Punks Jump Up from London. Their track is Mr. Overtime.
I think the TV talks to me. I see the things I shouldn't see. I left the house without the key. I crossed the line of this time. Imagination was running wild. I got my phone, I'll never charge it right. Those kinds of things, they always slip my mind. When I got home and opened up the blinds, must have forgot it was in broad daylight. Wish I could see all the red lights flash, just to avoid another body crash. Oh,
From London, that was Punk's Jump Up and Mr. Overtime. The time is 30 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. After the news, we'll be hearing about Seville's refuse collection strikes, recalling the health issues of Naples, all that and more coming up. Before that, here's Jonathan with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Syrian fighters opposed to President Bashar al-Assad's rule have clashed with the regime's army in an attempt to gain control of a strategic town. The fighters are attempting to gain control of key locations in Khan Asal, which is 7 miles west of Aleppo. FBI agents in Alabama have stormed an underground bunker and rescued a five-year-old boy who'd been held hostage by a gunman for nearly a week. The gunman, Jimmy Dykes, was killed in the attack. The new Secretary of State, John Kerry, will be ceremonially sworn in by Vice President Joe Biden at the State Department on Wednesday. Kerry became the top U.S. diplomat after 5 terms in the U.S. Senate. A few hundred European Union employees held a short strike today and gathered outside the EU Commission building to protest against possible cuts in their salaries. And here, the British Parliament has started a debate on the government's plans to legalise gay marriage, an issue that has split the ruling Conservative Party. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. Jonathan will be back in a little under a half an hour to bring us a full roundup of today's news. In the meantime, you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Now, there's quite a splendid photograph currently doing the rounds of Xi Jinping asleep on a bus. Slack-jawed and eyes closed, China's leader looks more like a weary tourist and less like the man in charge of the world's second biggest economy. The picture is one of a series that's appearing on the Chinese microblogging site Weibo, each one offering an intimate glimpse of a life usually channeled by the state media. So what's going on? Raffaella Pantucci is a senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. He joins me now. Raffaella, welcome to Midori House. These really are great pictures, aren't they?
They are. They're fantastic. I mean, it really shows the sort of it's a different way of seeing a Chinese politician. I mean, traditionally we've seen them in these very sort of scripted and very prepared positions, and here we see sort of more of a individual, more of a personality coming through.
We see pictures of him, as I mentioned, on a bus. But what are the other images? And they're accompanied by little captions that describe the minutiae of Xi Jinping's day.
Yeah. No, I mean, the other images sort of capture him going around. I noticed that another announcement that seems to have been done is he paid a visit to a military base. And this was sort of announced on Weibo as well. And this is apparently the first time that this has happened. So some of the sort of the more military press that exists in China has been sort of announcing this as another sort of aspect of the new things that the government is using Weibo for.
So who is doing this?
Well, I mean, that's the question. It's not exactly clear who exactly is managing this particular account. However, it would appear that it's someone who's clearly quite close to him. And so someone probably with the who's sort of managing his public persona, his own PR person. I mean, this is not the first time that Chinese politicians have used Weibo. It's just usually they've done it in a much more sort of formal fashion, let's put it that way. So in the past, we saw Wen Jiabao certainly used to do sort of question and answer sessions on Weibo, where he would sit at a computer for an hour and answer citizens' questions. But that was clearly him sort of answering these things in a sort of back and forth fashion. What's interesting about this is that it's someone within his entourage who seems to be sort of anonymously to some degree posting these pictures with these small sort of snippets showing the man sort of at work.
There's something almost voyeuristic about the picture. I'm thinking in particular of the one where he's asleep on the front seat of a bus. It doesn't quite have the intimacy and the laid-back style of let's say, reportage of Barack Obama at the White House. But one thing that struck me is that historically it is a sign of weakness for a leader to be pictured being asleep. Do photographs like this humanise Xi Jinping, or could they perhaps risk a dilution of his authority?
Well, I think you put your finger on a very curious question there. I think clearly the vision from the sort of Chinese authorities' perspective is to try to humanize him more. This is, you know, traditionally politicians, as I mentioned before, have been very sort of seen in a very sort of arch light and very sort of formal. And here clearly by portraying him like this, they're trying to show him as a man who's more sort of engaged with the people. You know, this is part of the endless struggle that they have within the Chinese system, where you have a sort of a very hierarchical party system that sort of rules the country, that can seem very detached to the ordinary citizen, but at the same time, it has to speak for the people, and it's sort of, you know, it's fundamentally a socialist model that is meant to be sort of people-oriented. So trying to bridge that divide is quite difficult. So, you know, this way of doing it is, I think, their approach. You know, the thing to emphasize is that so far the sort of scripted image of Xi Jinping that we've received has been one of a very confident leader. This has been sort of the point of all the emphasis, all the sort of meetings that he's had with foreigners and all the sort of official biographies that have sort of come out about him have portrayed him as a very confident man who's sort of been able to take charge of his own destiny kind of thing. So, you know, I think to some degree showing him in this light of being a man who also has to rest probably burnishes that image rather than detracts from it.
And to what degree do you think this is a very blatant attempt to harness the social media? I mean, we know just how influential Weibo is.
Well, I think Weibo's influence is a very complex question. And in fact, the sort of general feature of the netizen and the sort of netizen power and what power do they actually have? This is a dilemma that I think outsiders are struggling with, but I think the Chinese authorities are as well. Because on the one hand, they have pretty good control over their internet, and they can shut down discussions when they want to, even though netizens are very creative ways of continuing discussions by using, you know, homonyms or similar sounding words to sort of talk about subjects that are theoretically being blocked. So, you know, this in a way is a sort of more proactive approach to try to harness this medium, which to some degree they still don't quite know how to control.
They don't know how to control, but they do spend an awful lot of time and money on, is it called Weiwen, when they try and establish social stability within China. How has that particular approach been given since Xi Jinping came into power?
Well, I mean, the sort of stability narrative is been a very strong feature of the Hu administration. They were very focused on economic growth and political stability at home. In practice, that tended to play into a certain sort of stagnation. So in a way, that's a sort of hangover from before. So the fact that we're continuing to see this message comes through means that that's one that they continue to believe is clearly a priority. And, you know, in this sort of interregnum period you have between the 18th Party Congress late last year in November and the sort of formal ascension of Xi Jinping to his duties in March is a sort of awkward political space, which, you know, they're clearly stability is the priority to focus on during that period.
And given that, what do you think the effect of these quite remarkable photographs will have on China's international soft power?
Well, again, I think this is another element of it that's to be borne in mind. I think, you know, they're trying to portray Xi as a different sort of leader. China has struggled a great deal, and I know this from talking to officials in various ministries and academics and researchers and analysts and journalists. You know, they trying to portray China's soft power image abroad is something that they expend a lot of energy trying to figure out how to do better. I remember anecdotally someone the other day mentioned to me that, you know, the Chinese have spent millions on trying to figure out this soft power and how to get China's image right. One Korean guy did a funny dance and a song, and, you know, the whole world has suddenly gone South Korean crazy. They don't know how to sort of repeat that with China. And so I think this sort of approach of humanizing Xi through Weibo is maybe one facet of a sort of broader strategy.
Raffaello Pantucci, many thanks, as ever, for joining us today here on Monocle 24. The time has just gone 39 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment with some music and a tour of the rubbish-strewn streets of Seville.
Ever since Monocle launched in 2007, we've championed a roll-your-sleeves-up, put-on-your-overalls attitude to problems and possibilities. The how-to section in our February issue catches up with business owners, innovators, and cultural figures creating new ways to work. And the list is an eclectic mix.
A group of frontline do-gooders.
Chilean entrepreneurs going out on a limb for olive oil.
Nashville-based singer-songwriter Caitlin Rose.
Ceramic makers injecting life into San Francisco's city centre with a new manufacturing hub.
And we head to the Maldives to meet the entrepreneur who set up a one-man airline.
To learn from the experts how to make, do or mend your business or your ambition, watch our how-to slideshow on monocle.com.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive and savour.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Todd Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Welcome back to Midori House. Just to let you know, at 1900 hours London time, Hugo MacDonald will be your host for this week's edition of Section D. We'll be heading to the United States for the inaugural design conference at the Harvard Schools of Business and Design, amongst other treats. That's all coming up in a little under 20 minutes' time. In the meantime, the time is 1841 here in London, 1941 in Madrid, and Seville is getting smelly. Its refuse collectors are on strike, and for the last fortnight, rubbish has been piling up on the streets. It's left the city historic roads reeking, and it's driven away tourism in a time of unemployment and low economic morale. There are reports of some torching of the rubbish at night. Well, let's get the latest from Monocle's man in Spain, Liam Aldous. Liam, welcome to the programme as ever. Just explain to us why these refuse collectors are on strike in the first place.
Well, they're on strike just like other strikes that have been going on in Andalusia in recent months because of cutbacks to their salaries. So there was one huge strike in Jerez, which is just near Cádiz. It's a small town. And that lasted 21 days, and it was in the warmer months. So you can imagine the smell that the residents were having to deal with. Then there was one earlier this year in Granada, and that lasted 13 days. And now we have one in Seville, which is in its second week, and there's about 4,000 kilos of rubbish piling up on the streets.
So what is the situation like there now?
Well, I did call up some of my sources on the streets. I didn't want to talk to some of the striking workers because I knew that they'd be full of bellicose statements and maybe talking some rubbish as well. So I talked to some people I know, and they said that, yeah, there's quite a lot of bags on the street. And the smell, though, isn't a factor because they're lucky enough that it's winter, so the sun isn't that strong, although it is still quite warm in Seville. But there's a lot of rubbish in the inner city, and my sources told me that the workers are trying to leave a lot of rubbish in the richer districts just to put more pressure on the government.
Putting pressure on the government, are they actually getting anywhere? You've mentioned two strikes in Spain in the last few months where the refuse collectors dumped the rubbish on the streets. How are those resolved, and can you see a resolution to this one?
Well, they were resolved. Basically, the first one, which was the very long one, the workers eventually came to the negotiating table and accepted a 10% wage cut, where the demands were actually a lot bigger than that. So they did make some sacrifice. And then in Granada, they were asked to have about a 10% pay cut as well, but in the end, they only got a 2.5% pay cut, and they kept all of their benefits. So, I mean, it did work. So maybe that's what's led to this situation in Seville, that they've seen that it works, and so they're just holding on. So the governments themselves have been trying to cut back on everything, so they're trying to save money. But the workers, especially the rubbish collectors, have a few pressure tools up their sleeves. They know that if they leave the rubbish, they don't do their job, people are going to get angry, and the government's going to have to fold eventually.
And in the meantime, what are people doing to try to dispose of their waste?
Well, you did mention in your intro that some of the bins are being set alight, and while accusations are being made against the workers have come out and said, well, it's not us, because we want the rubbish to be on the streets. It's part of our strategy, so it's not us. And it doesn't really make sense that they're setting them alight. But The authorities are saying that it's hooligans, but in some of the other strikes, they've interviewed a lot of people in the streets, a lot of the media have gone down there, and it seems that the residents themselves have been setting it alight because of the smell. So in Jerez particularly, there were a lot of fires, and they were just saying it's better just to burn it because it keeps the rats away and it keeps the smell away. But in Seville, the smell isn't really an issue, so they're just saying it's hooligans and perhaps bored children who don't have jobs and just want a little bit of excitement. I mean, that's a theory.
Liam, stay with us if you would, because comparisons are being drawn between the situation in Seville and a similar crisis that left the streets of Naples filled with rubbish in 2008. Indeed, it's been an ongoing problem for the city for the last three decades. Now, the director of the Sbarro Institute for Cancer Research at Temple University in Philadelphia is Antonio Giordano. He joins us on the line now. Signor Giordano has carried out studies into the health risks associated with refuse issues. Welcome to the programme. Could you just explain to us, Liam there was describing people setting fire to rubbish in the streets. What are the long-term health implications of having this amount of rubbish piled up and what people do to it when they take matters into their own hands?
I think the situation could be very serious for the reason that even the rubbish on the street could contain several different substances. And the most dangerous things when they produce this leachate, that is a liquid that extracts solutes and can contaminate also the ground, the land. And therefore, this one really was one of the major problem while all the garbage got accumulated during during months and years. In addition, there is this kind of leachate, this liquid that is produced and mixed to all the different substances in the garbage can produce also pathogenic microorganisms. And often, if a proper cleanup has been done, will be done. I mean, that could cause also a certain type of infectious disease.
We're talking about the situation in Naples, which has dragged on for decades, and that obviously is something that can be monitored and will have long-term effects on our population. But if you have these flash strikes that last for little more than a couple of weeks or so, are people really at that much of a risk, or is it just temporarily horrible?
No, it's a matter of a risk. Of course, depends of the time, okay, that the population and the environment is exposed to this. And sometimes the population still is desperate or in a very illegal way. Sometimes they burn this this trash. And that's actually one of the worst things also that can be done, because they produce typically dioxin. And dioxin, as everybody knows, is a substance that really can provoke several type of disease and the long run genetic malformation and cancer.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Professor Antonio Giordano. Listening to that, Liam, is anybody in Seville remotely aware of these huge long-term health problems that people seem to be storing up?
Well, they are aware, and a lot of them are angry. But like I said, I talked to a lot of people on the ground, and a lot of people seem to understand that the workers shouldn't be suffering these pay cuts. But then they also mentioned that there are laws which require the garbage collectors to pick up a lot of refuse from around hospitals and around abattoirs, and around about a minimum of 30% of the rubbish in general. So, like I said, the strategy was to keep as much rubbish in the richer neighbourhoods, but they are picking up a minimum. So we're not at the extreme situation yet, but the smell could be a problem eventually. We're in our second week, Emma.
Liam Aldous, Monocle's man in Spain, thank you very much as ever. And before that, Antonio Giordano, who's a director of the Sbarro Institute for Cancer Research at Temple University in Philadelphia. You're with Midori House. You're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London, where the time is fast approaching 18:50. Now, in a nation where writers have in the past paid the highest price for freedom of expression, Burma has for the first time celebrated literature of all persuasions and views without apparent fear of retribution by the state. The first Irrawaddy three-day literary festival in Burma brought together a mix of former political prisoners, poets and internationally renowned authors, whose reputation was perhaps lost on many of the local attendees formerly kept in the dark. Monocle's Ali Fowle reports from Burma on how freedom of expression was the focus of this event.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's rare to hear quite such an excitable reaction from a crowd at a literary festival. But this occasion was one with a difference. Burma's first ever international literary festival was launched by British Ambassador to Burma, Andrew Heim, in Rangoon on Friday, to a turnout worthy of the historic occasion.
I've been talking about the groundbreaking nature of this event for a while, but seeing it today, you realise quite how groundbreaking it is. We have around 25 international authors who've come a long way to be part of this. We're incredibly grateful to them. And we have no less than 120 authors from this country taking part.
With one of the world's worst records for freedom of speech under the former military regime, Burma has suffered under heavy censorship for many years. The turnout reflected the enthusiasm surrounding this liberating event, with almost 9,000 tickets sold over the 3 days of the festival. The popularity of the occasion was irrefutably influenced by the attendance of the patron of the event, Burma's iconic opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
I think many people in Burma share my hopes and aspirations, and I would like to see literature as a binding force, a unifying force, as well as one that will open us up to the rest of the world and the differences that we cannot avoid finding outside our own country.
However, many other internationally renowned names in attendance, such as BBC correspondent Fergal Keane and Yung Chang, author of Wild Swans, may have been lost on some of the Burmese crowd, most of whom have lived through two decades of literary isolation. But what did not go unnoticed were the topics open for discussion.
My name is Timothy Garton Ash. I'm a contemporary historian at Oxford University, a writer, political commentator. And the particular relevance to this theme is that I lead a big project at Oxford University on global free speech, a subject on which I'm writing a book.
A talk on free speech on the first day, moderated by a former colleague of Michael Eris, Aung San Suu Kyi's late husband, had a strong turnout. Garton Ash was blacklisted from Burma for 12 years after a visit in the year 2000.
By the time I came here in the year 2000, I had travelled in some of the worst totalitarian regimes in the world. Stalinist Albania, the Soviet Union, East Germany with the Stasi secret police. This was probably the worst. One of the most beautiful countries in the world and one of the ugliest regimes. Appearance of
anything, not in line. Burmese panelists at the talk spoke to the audience about their experience writing under censorship.
At the height of government control, which existed until recently, we had pre-press censorship of all forms of publications.
Pei Min, a prominent Burmese writer, praised the changes he has experienced.
There are many things which we can't write before, we are now writing. Now we don't need to think about those censors, and we can write what we should write.
I've seen quite a few transitions in my time, and this is just extraordinary.
Gartenash paid tribute to writers who have been imprisoned for their work in the past under Burma's notorious penal system.
The serious point here is that writers in this country paid a very, very high price for their courage in the battle for free speech. And before we do anything else, ladies and gentlemen, I think we should give a particularly warm round of applause to all those writers and intellectuals in Burma who fought for free speech for so many years. Please join me.
So I was charged according to the printing law number 17 and 20. It's the printing of the illegal manuscripts.
Martheda is an author who was imprisoned for almost 6 years in 1991 for distributing uncensored material. In the past, she's had her books banned and destroyed by censorship. But 3 months ago, she was able to publish a book about her experience in prison for the first time. And she says it feels like a dream.
This book is very, very critical. In this book, what I have written is so critical. And then somebody say it's dangerous. When I noticed the press scrutiny board relax a bit about their rules and regulations, I submitted this manuscript to the press scrutiny board, but they didn't give me any answer. They just kept my manuscript for months and months until and unless the censorship process has been abolished. And then as soon as we noticed, we started printing and doing all the things. So that's why finally I can make this book published. And I'm so, so happy.
The talks at the festival were held in both Burmese and English and covered a variety of topics from food and travel to witnessing violence. Some of the issues covered would have been impossible to discuss in a public forum like this just 1 year ago. But concerns were raised during the festival about self-censorship. Paymient says some writers are still scared of being penalised if they speak out.
They lifted the pre-censorship, but they haven't repealed or amended the laws that enforce the censorship. So we are thought to be free, but the laws that prohibited us still remains.
However, Martheda says events like this will help ensure that the government cannot go back on the changes that have occurred.
It's not irreversible, but it's hard to go back because the public has been aroused. Publics have been aware what is going on. They won't be keep silent. They won't be keep naive. So that's the way that the promising thing is the whole population has been aware and aroused already.
And nowhere was that clearer than throughout the literary festival. With hundreds of visitors from home and abroad crowded around every event, the entire weekend had an electric atmosphere. Traditional music, marionettes, poetry readings, workshops and book sales all proved popular.
Afterwards with Human Rights Watch,
but the truly distinctive aspect was to witness international and Burmese writers discussing issues that would previously have been unimaginable to talk about in public, freely and unreservedly in Burma. For Monocle, in Rangoon, I'm Ali Fowle.
That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to my producer, Alad John, my researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Next up is Section D. We'll be heading to the US for the inaugural design conference at the Harvard School of Business and Design in 3 hours' time, 22 hours London time, of course. Andrew Muller and Marcus Hippie will be your hosts for the Monocle Daily. Robert Bound will be in the hot seat for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thanks for listening.